those of you who were here last week, and then certainly part of this week, there have been various experimental studies of what might be the pairing interaction, what's the pairing glue. And as we know in those, it's not so simple. You have to devise somehow an experiment that gets at the thing you'd like to measure. And so we've heard various ways of getting at it. Today, I want to talk about some numerical calculations that were done by Mark Jarrell, Thomas Mayer, and myself, with the notion of, suppose someone gave you a model. This is going to be the Hubbard model, but what I'm talking about is more general. Suppose they gave you a model, and you had numerical control of it, what would you calculate to look at the glue? So that's what this is about. Okay, so at any rate, let's see what happens. What we're going to see partway through is that what we call the effective pairing interaction is actually the irreducible particle-particle vertex. And what this means is you can't come in here and cut this graph at that point if you cut just two lines. Okay? So it doesn't have any pieces. Thanks. There should... Okay, so you can't cut that into two sections. And so the question, of course, for us is, how do you measure this object, which is a function of momentum, momentum transfer, and energies? And I would say the experiment has somewhat the same problem. Quite often, the experiment will, in some ways, try and identify what this might be, and then tip this vertex somehow and come in on this channel and try and talk about what it might be. Numerically, we have similar problems as to how we determine what it is, and so let me try and talk about that for a while. So, the things that we can measure with a Monte Carlo happen to be Green's functions. So we can measure a single particle Green's function here. P might stand for both momentum and spin. We also can measure a two-particle Green's function. That's probably the one edge we have on experiment. If you think about high energy, they're really good at that. They can come in with two particles, they can get at the vertex, and they can come out the far side. And in principle, depending on the nature of the collision, they can try and understand this particle, or in our case, particle-hole vertex. We have a very hard time doing that in a solid-state system. Numerically, though, we can get at it. So we can get at this function and this function, and then the question's going to be, and this will take us a bit of time, how do we go from that information to what we might call the glue? Okay, so again, what have I said? What I've said is we have the capabilities with Monte Carlo of measuring this function. This function could be just two lines coming through. It could be lines coming through with a full vertex. So this is a full vertex that includes everything in the problem. It's not irreducible, and it's going to be the object that we first grab onto and then try and extract from it some of what we want. It's an interesting object in the sense it obeys crossing symmetry. If you do it exactly, it obeys all the symmetries of the problem, and it's a thing that in many body physics, if we did this perturbatively, we have a very hard time knowing how to calculate. On the other hand, we're not doing it perturbatively. We're going to do it numerically, and we're just going to extract it, but we're going to pay some prices because we're going to do it on a smaller lattice in momentum space. So there's going to be some smoothing going on. All right, so why do I mention this equation? This is what the Monte Carlo measures, where P prime is actually momentum and omega n prime. We're in Matsubara space because the Fourier transform has been done on that Green's function. And of course, it's just the straight through guy, which you can get rid of. And then finally, we see the guy we want right here. So if you grab this, you divide by 4 g's, and you're careful of some factors of t over n, you can extract this full vertex. And that's the thing we first work with, but it's not the thing we want. Okay, so this just says once we've calculated the full vertex and g, which we can do with Monte Carlo, then we can go after this thing called the irreducible particle-particle interaction, which is the interaction in this model that's going to cause whatever pairing we have. And at this point, naturally we have in the back of our minds D wave, but the interaction will tell us what kind of pairing we have. We're not putting that in. So we've used it, and in a few minutes we'll talk about how we use it. So now again, perhaps gets a little messy. We have our hands on this full vertex. If we choose, we can look in the particle-particle channel. If we look in the particle-particle channel, we can write it as an irreducible piece, meaning you can't separate this diagram by cutting two lines, plus this irreducible piece going back into the full vertex. It's just the standard T-matrix equation. But the difference here is, because we have this and the G's, we have a hope of solving this T-matrix backwards. What does that mean? Most of your time, if you did money-body physics 20 years ago, you spent your time trying to guess what might be a good irreducible vertex. And then you put it in, and you did your best to solve the T-matrix to get the full vertex. Here it's a little weird. Because we can, with Monte Carlo, calculate the full vertex and the complete Green's function, and what we want to know is what the irreducible vertex is, we take this term, let's see what we do. We take this, which we know, we take this and put it on the other side, and we solve for what we want. Now, admittedly, this is an iterative solution, because we have this and we have the G's. And so you've got to iterate around on this until you find this irreducible piece. But that's what's done. Najat Balut was the first person I know who did this. All right. I know that's long, but that's our experimental technique on this numerical experiment. So now, suppose we found the particle-particle irreducible vertex, and I didn't describe it, but we could have twisted the whole thing and come down in the particle-hole channel, and we could have asked the same question, what's the irreducible particle-hole vertex, if we wanted to, and we do. Suppose we have those. Then this guy will be our primary focus, because that's what the talk is about, and we'd like to know about its structure. We'd like to know how it depends on momentum transfer, energy transfer, and temperature, just to look at it. We're going to do that in a minute. But first, just because we have hold of it, we're going to look at something that tells us about the instabilities in the different channels. And so we're going to look at the leading eigenvalues of beta-Salpeter equation. What beta-Salpeter equation is somehow an exact for this system BCS equation, if you want to think about it. You're looking in the particle channel. If you're looking in particle hole, then you're looking at charge or spin instabilities. But at any rate, again, just to say again, I draw lines that look like Green's functions. I draw vertexes. The lines are fully dressed Green's functions because we're doing Monte Carlo. And the vertexes are fully, how to put it, they have everything in it. And our problem is we don't know what that everything is. All right, so how does it work? The beta-Salpeter equation grabs what you call this irreducible part. It puts a couple of legs on it, goes into an amplitude, and it becomes an eigenvalue equation. And when you solve this, the leading eigenvalue tells you what's the most unstable thing in that channel. And when this eigenvalue were ever to reach 1, that would be a point at which there would be an honest instability. Okay? So we have our hands on this. We know this and this. And this would say, in our case, for singlet, be spin up, spin down. The truth is that would pick out both triplet and singlet. But at any rate, we then would look at the eigenvalues and try and see who's winning, or what's happening in whatever model you gave us. Yes, you can. And what you get then is instead of the eigenvalue lambda, you get lambda alpha over 1 minus lambda alpha. So you have your choice already. The way we're doing it, I decided to do this because what I'm really after is other things. But let me just show you how we would test what the model is doing. In the same way, you can look at the particle hole channel. Here, you have to picture I'm looking down at my vertex this way. And again, I can look for eigenvalues. Now the question is, what do you find? Oh, I'm sorry. This is sort of, perhaps to put it in another context. This equation for the D-wave eigenvalue, if the D-wave eigenvalue lambda went to 1, would be the analog of something that's so low you probably can't see it. It's the BCS equation, BCS gap equation. It would be the analog of it. The difference being this guy has the full momentum and dynamics of whatever the model contains. So that's the beast we have a hold of. And now, how were the results obtained? I guess about 10 years ago, Najat Balut and I were looking at 8x8 lattices and doing standard Monte Carlo and playing the same game up to a point that I'll show you. But we could never get it very cold, and we could watch some of the things that were happening. Now, Mark Jarrell and his group at Cincinnati have developed a dynamic cluster, Monte Carlo, and this has allowed them to go to lower temperatures, and it's what Thomas Mayer and Mark Jarrell have been using on this problem to look at some of the results. One of the prices is we're going to be down on a somewhat small lattice in momentum space that I'll show you in a bit. It's a smooth operation. In fact, sorry, this is the lattice. So here's Kx and Ky, and this happens to be, I think, a 24-site cluster. And so if you're after anything that varies rapidly on this sort of a scale, you aren't going to pick it up in this calculation. On the other hand, our picture is that the interaction we're after is rather short range in space, dominantly near neighbor, maybe next near neighbor, that in frequency it's governed by an energy that's probably smaller than the exchange energy, and hence on a small lattice at not too low a temperature, we ought to be able to see the interaction forming, even though we aren't going to go to temperatures where we see the consequences of that interaction giving us a D-wave superconducting state. At any rate, that's the sort of lattice. And now, what happens? Well, that's the answer to the question I just posed. Okay, why do we think we could do this? Well, maybe. Okay. Now, what this shows is what happens if you solve the beta-Salpeter equation and you begin lowering the temperature. Here, the temperature is measured in units of the hopping. And this is for a model in which we have U over T of 4. U over T of 8 would be equal to bandwidth. We have no T prime, and it's doped to 0.85. So this is a doped Hubbard cluster of the type I showed you. And we're now looking at the eigenvalues. And sure enough, as we cool, the leading eigenvalue occurs in the particle hole, spin one channel, with momentum pi pi. Now you might say, well, I know a doped system doesn't have the strongest response at pi pi. We know from neutron scattering gets split away. But remember, the momentum space lattice I showed you is a bit coarse. And so what it picks up is the pi pi. At any rate, it rises. If we were half filled, Glute and I had looked at this, we were half-filled, this sucker comes up and then does a beautiful thing. Near one, it comes in with an exponential behavior rather than crossing. And the reason it does that is it knows that it mustn't have a transition temperature until T equals zero. But at any rate, this guy comes up and saturates. The blue line is the D wave. And now in other calculations that Mayer and Gerald did, they went to yet lower temperatures for some of these Hubbard models they looked at. And they did find cases where this got to one or very near one. We aren't there. We're in here. And in fact, the data I'll show you has to do with this temperature, and that temperature. We're just starting to come up here. And the question is, what does our interaction look like, and what can we say about it? So that's what's going to happen. So these were eigenvalues. These are, again, the cluster of points. And I'm just going to now show you something else about the eigenequation. I called that leading eigenvalue in the pair channel dx squared minus y squared. How do I know that? Well, I can calculate the eigenfunction, which you have to think of as like the gap. So I can look at its momentum dependence, and I can look at its momentum dependence as I go here to here to here to here, and then because it's periodic, we plot it in the way you'll see. Oh, I'm sorry, this shows you where we're moving. Okay, there's the eigenfunction of the leading eigenvalue, and we didn't draw a cosine through here because we have some taste. We only had a small number of points. This is clearly best it can do for D-wave. And mind you, we're not putting this in. This is being coughed back out to us from the Monte Carlo calculation of the irreducible vertex. Its frequency dependence we have in Matsubara space, and it's dropping off, and I believe it's dropping off on a scale, in this case, rather near T, but this is the same scale that we find the magnetic fluctuations dropping off at, and I believe it's correlated with them. If it were flat here, it would be an instantaneous interaction, but this is retarded. Peter? You have to understand, the question is, can I go back? Yeah.
So you said this is the lowest eigenvalue?
The high, I meant, I said it wrong. This is the leading eigenvalue.
Right, this is the leading one, not the second leading one. So this should correspond to amplitude or magnitude.
Oh, good question. I didn't explain it carefully. I should have brought that along to show you, which is interesting, but I'll tell you about it. If I look at the Beta-Salpeter equation and use gamma pp, the irreducible particle-particle piece, I get this. If I use the irreducible particle-whole piece and examine it in a channel with q equal pi pi, that's the leading antiferromagnetic one, and I get a new eigenvalue. We call those psi, and these phi, to keep them separate in our mind. Now, that one's interesting, because what that one does is that one's extremely constant in momentum. What does that mean? It means the excitation is Cp plus QCp with a coefficient Aq that's just about constant. It's just what you would expect. Furthermore, its frequency dependence, it comes down and then it's very flat. It's basically instantaneous, which is just what, so I should have brought it along, but I didn't. What's the frequency dependence? Okay. So the leading eigenvalue in the pairing channel at this low temperature has D wave symmetry. What can you say now about this interaction? What is the glue in this model? Okay. What's its momentum, frequency, temperature dependence? Is the glue associated with some sort of particle-hole exchange? What channel? What spin does it carry? Or is it associated with an interaction that's not well described in those terms? We're going to see we have a possibility of a fully irreducible piece, irreducible in all three channels, which would be some, in my mind, extremely complicated set of Feynman diagrams that you would step back and say, this way of talking is not a useful way of describing what's happening. So that's what we're going to try and understand now. Okay, now here's a sketch. I have yet to develop my artistry. This is a schematic of what this looks like. As a function of momentum transfer, as you go out towards pi and out towards pi pi, this interaction gets large and positive. And in here, it's smaller, but still fairly large. And it looks like this, but there are no wiggles here. I got a wiggle, I'm sorry. Now I'm cutting out along this axis. And now, unfortunately, on our smaller lattice, we're only going to be able to show you 4 points. And so I'm going to continue to simply look at what happens along there and see what the interaction looks like. So that's where we're going. All right, so this is the numerical data. This is the irreducible interaction. Again, at the lowest temperature we can go, where each of the lines carry pi t, and they're probably one with a minus and one with plus, so the center of mass is carrying zero energy. And at high temperature, this thing's kind of a vegetable. It's a little bigger than U, which was 4. It's just a repulsive vegetable. As you cool it, I hope you can see two things. One is it's beginning to peak up at pi pi. There is some curvature in this. That's the D wave aspect of it. And furthermore, at the lowest two temperatures, it's not changing so radically, which is what I would hope and expect. We're cooled down. Once you get down below some characteristic energy on which the interaction is going to form, it may well stay there a while before you drop to low enough temperatures that that interaction can cause the D wave pairing. So we're in some intermediate regime where hopefully in this model we got it cold enough to talk about the interaction and that it's not going to change too much as we go down further. All right, now. Yeah.
In the last picture, since it's possible that the effective interaction range is further on in space, right? And so here we see how from pi pi to 2 pi over 3, 2 pi over 3, it's a drop by how many percent?
Drop.
Then I would say, wouldn't that also give rise to a little further range?
Oh, yeah. I'm sorry. I should have said, if you Fourier transform this, suppose you have a function of q. Suppose you take e to the I q dot r. So now you want to see the interaction in space. What happens is you'll find this interaction is extremely repulsive on site, which is telling you if you ever pair it on site, you pay a huge price. It will be attractive on the immediate near neighbors. On the next near neighbor out, it will be slightly repulsive, and then it will oscillate a bit and damp as you go out. And we have plots of that, and again, I didn't put one on here, so I'm sorry. But yes, you see that. Well, think about it this way for a minute. Suppose you draw a straight line through here.
Okay.
That, if the interaction were that, then you and I know it would just be repulsive on sight and have zero range. Now, there's a little bit of curvature here, and how far out does that carry you? And that's the part I'm telling you about. I didn't bring the plots, but it doesn't carry you very far. Okay, so far what have we learned? Frequency dependence of the irreducible particle-particle interaction is reflected in this omega n dependence of this eigenfunction, and it has, from what we know about the susceptibility, basically, spin susceptibility, basically that type of frequency dependence. But we need to do more here. Its momentum dependence I've shown you, and now, that's its frequency dependence again. We've already talked about that. Now we come to the reason I'm giving this talk. Somehow or another, quite a long time ago, when Balut and I were first trying these things, we first could never get to the temperatures or do the sort of thing that Mark Jarrell and Mayer can do. Okay? So they brought along, and they have developed, and Mark has developed, a remarkable set of numerical tools. But what I didn't remember is something I should have. I came to Santa Barbara in 68, and I came because I had a friend who was in graduate school with me at Stanford, a guy named Dick Blankenbeckler, who unfortunately the year after I came here left to go to SLAC. But at any rate, Blankenbeckler is a marvelous high-energy physicist, and at the time, he and Haymaker were working on trying to understand, I think, a picture that Jeff Chu had of what you ought to do. That you ought to be able to calculate the irreducible particle-particle vertex, irreducible in this channel, and you ought to be able to write it as something fully introduced, irreducible in all three channels. They used to call this in high energy SUV, I think, but at any rate, all three channels. So this was some incredibly, in our case, not incredibly, some high order graph because it's irreducible no matter whether you cut it this way, it's fully two fermion line, irreducible in all three channels. I don't know what it is. And then a piece that cuts across this way that if you have the exact vertex, which we do, and its particle hole irreducible piece, you can calculate it. And there's another one where the lines are slightly more twisted. Okay? And this is exact. It was used by people as parquet approximate, but we aren't using it as parquet. We got everything we need here. So the game is going to be calculate this and this, and then use one more thing, which I hope says here. Because this Hamiltonian is spin rotation invariant, we can separate out those two channels I showed you into a channel carrying spin 0, which is charge, and a channel carrying spin 1, which is a spin fluctuation. And we can write our irreducible guy as a fully, this is irreducible in the particle-particle channel, it's the pair interaction, as a fully irreducible object, as a charge fluctuation exchange, particle-hole charge fluctuation, and a spin exchange, okay, with coefficients. And now comes the end of the story, except I don't know whether it shows well enough. Now you can just look at the data and you can say, okay, original data I showed you that we got from the Monte Carlo, I guess you can see here, but it's what I was describing as we lower the temperature and we cut out large momentum transfer near pi. It looks like this. It's growing. Now we want to know, it's the glue. We want to know what the glue is due to. So we come and we look at something we cannot calculate, so I should be careful. We can calculate this channel, because we have gamma. So we can look at the spin channel, we can look at the charge channel. You can see the spin channel is really taking off. The poor old charge channel will look weird to you because it's negative, but that's because we've subtracted off U, because that's contained in this beast. Now this is the fully irreducible one that we cannot calculate. But what we do is we take this, subtract this, 3/2 of this, or whatever, subtract this, and we get this, and once again, this object is pretty much a vegetable. Vegetable meaning not strong momentum dependence. We don't know its frequency dependence. I don't believe it's strong. And it's fairly flat. So we conclude that the guts of the glue is coming out of the spin 1 channel. So the conclusions of this these set of calculations by Mayer and by Gerald. The effective interaction in the 2D Hubbard model, and again, U over T of 4, doping of 0.85, it leads to D-wave pairing, meaning the largest eigenvalue in the pairing channel is D-wave, and as they cool further, it continues to rise. The interaction itself increases with increasing momentum transfer. This means in real space, it's repulsive for on-site and attractive for near neighbor. It decreases when omega n exceeds an effective exchange interaction. That means it's somewhat retarded. And here's the new thing that somehow we couldn't get our hands on before. It's mediated by a spin 1 channel. And there's just to conclude with some questions. Okay, go back. Thank you. You could ask a number of questions. Does a doped 2D Hubbard model actually have a superconducting phase? And if this is the case, does it occur at high TC? We've not addressed that problem. It would seem to me in this model, what they find is the TC can be, 0.025T. And of course, if you make T 0.4 electron volts, you can get 60 degrees or something. But I think there's a question. Is this the right model? Do you need T prime? Do you need other things? This doesn't address that one. The eigenvalue on some of the clusters they've looked at, they're able to get to a low enough temperature, they're able to drive it to 1. But these are, what are they called? Cluster, dynamic cluster approximation. They have a mean field feedback in them. So again, I myself am not so interested in whether the thing can get to 1. I happen to be interested in what's happening on the way up there, what's the character of it, since I believe that character doesn't change. But that's part of the discussion. And suppose the model didn't go, and suppose you concluded, geez, you need T prime. Or suppose you concluded you need a next near neighbor V. That's okay with me, because I don't know how to do that yet. This is more, if you had a model, and someone came to you and said, do you have some somewhat unbiased way of telling me about the model and what glues it together? I claim that's what this is. The question of enhancement mechanisms, as you know, Kivelson, Emery, have talked about the fact that, yeah, you may have these mechanisms, even the one I've just talked about, but you enhance it by breaking up the system into two-leg ladders or breaking it up into domains in some way. You can well imagine from discussions we had last week, you could say, look, your little calculation here is for U over T of 4. Why don't you show us U over T of 8? Well, Blute and I did U over T of 8. It gets dicier there. Here, U over T of 8 gives us more noise, and they're working on it. We would like to do it larger, but you could say, look, when you get beyond a certain U, say U bigger than the bandwidth or bigger than 1.5 the bandwidth, you go through some critical situation where it qualitatively changes. And therefore, the quote mechanism, therefore, my explanation of the Hubbard mechanism is for this U over T of 4. Again, I don't believe it, but you know, we don't care so much what people believe. It's a question of what you can show. So anyway, I would say to summarize it, if I could go back, those are the conclusions. Thanks.
As your irreducible vertex is kind of structureless, should you have taken as well just U as irreducible vertex?
No.
The same results, or is that
no? Better? Let's say a comment on that. The irreducible vertex was this object that had some momentum dependence. Suppose we took U so that it were flat, okay? Then it would have the D-wave eigenvalue would be 0. In other words, there would be no way it could pair a D-wave.
Also for the totally irreducible vertex, not for
lambda.
For lambda. Yes, for lambda. Let me.
I don't know.
I'll find it. Now we come. Just a second. Since I can't see. Sorry. Yeah, let's come here. All I want to do is play. Just 1 minute. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. What you're seeing here is, look, at our highest temperature, this guy is just about U, because I told you it was 4. So it's just about U. Now, what's happening? Well, what's happening is if you try to write, which I should draw for you, the lowest order graph in Hubbard, it's fully irreducible in all three channels. I believe it's going to be of order u to the sixth, but whatever it is, it's a high order graph with many legs going through. My picture has always been that if what's going on is some exotic situation, then you're going to find in the irreducible interaction, that's where the exotic physics will lay, because it won't be well described in terms of particles and holes. It's going to be exotic. But this thing is actually quite flat. It's increased slightly. And you could pick some value in and then start your calculation off. The problem I think you would have is, what Green's function would you use? And the answer is, we know there are people with cluster Green's functions and others, but you need a Green's function that knows something about the Mott physics. And so the beauty, or whatever, of the numerical work is we don't have to address that. We pull it off of the same calculation that is going after G2.
Just doing a Parquet summation with that totally irreducible U, vertex taken to be U, would not really suffice.
Well, it wouldn't give any. The truth is, if you look at it, it would suppress B wave. It's going this way. You have to go this way to get enhanced. Okay. Javier, I'm sorry.
This talk was essentially focused on the pertinence, but you have the best thing assumptions. On some apprentice with what Jaro did, you have a spectral function for the brain function. I just want to know if this is this guy with the 200 peaks central.
Yeah, it's a good. It's a good question, and I don't know. What I do know is, in this range, Nejad and I went after it, and as you know, you have it in Matsubara frequency. We never had the nerve to analytically continue it, but other people have. And so yours is a good question, and I don't know what his looks like at that point. I think my suspicion is that the way, my belief is that the way the N omega looks, which we did look at once, is this way. That's what I believe N omega looks at, because we did look at that once. But you're asking about A of K omega, and I should try and get that data. I don't have it.
Like one of these dynamical mean field approximations plus additional
sign. So I want to be careful. You're asking me whether we're going to see something here. I don't think we will. I don't think it's there. It's there for some people, but not for the good guys.
Can you say something about what sort of blue we are talking about? We know the spin.
Yeah. One. You know the spin is one.
Very localized. It's like a spin flip that is living together with the two carriers in a sort of three body bound state, or maybe a more extended wavish.
You remember the book? I think it's called The Name of the Rose. What's his name? Echo. Yeah, remember, there's a word that you must never say because you will be killed. Okay? That word is, this is anti-ferromagnetic spin fluctuations. But you notice I didn't say that, Albiel. It carries spin 1. It's peaked out at pi, and it's clearly heavily damped. So it's not, it's a fluctuation, not a magnon. But it has a momentum and frequency dependence that reminds me of what we see in neutron data. But it's certainly not the resonance, because we're above TC, and it's coming from a broad... I mean, one other thing we have, but I didn't bring it because it's not done with the same method, is I think you'll see in a review by Balut that he's analytically continued chi of Q omega summed over all Q. And he gets, you know, a broad region that has to do with where the neutrons, I believe, also see a large spectral region. I think that's the meaning of it, but you know, like I said, with the name of the rose, what we can say is this is a spin 1, near pi, it's certainly structured. I mean, you know, you could see it's not peak, but you know, it's coming up, and we know it's frequency dependence, and that's what we know about this thing called the irreducible pairing interaction.
So how do you understand then, you know, from a neutron scattering experiment, as you go away from half the feeling that the scattering speed becomes weaker?
Yeah. How do you understand that, and yet the superconductivity comes on? I agree with you. I guess what I picture is that you're doing an experiment that's sending the neutrons and creating a particle hole, and it's going into the vertex that I have the cross channel on. But you have a GG and a GG surrounding that vertex. And in addition, I have a 3/2 U squared sitting in front of it. Now, you can say, well, what units am I in? It's probably 3/2 U squared over T, something like that. And you start letting the coefficient in front of it get large, and you have quite a strong interaction, even though the chi itself, imaginary part of chi, might not appear so strong. But again, you say, well, but it's getting weaker, and so why is TC doing it? Again, the difficulty, I don't know, but the difficulty will be the GG I spoke about. The gap-like equation I had was this kernel, GG phi. Well, GG, as you go near half filling, is starting to develop its own Mott-Hubbard pseudo-gap. And that's wreaking havoc with what is a really good interaction. And so my picture is, and what we seem to find here, is while this interaction may be getting stronger, the darn GG it's playing off of is developing its own Mott-Hubbard or pseudo-gap. I should have, I think, mentioned this. The reason that I'm so interested in the Hubbard model now is that it is a model, rather a very simple model, that has anti-ferromagnetism, hints of D-wave superconductivity, pseudo-gap behavior from what various people, Gerald and others, and the group at Sherbrooke, André-Marie Tremblay, are finding, and White and I found it had stripes under some circumstances. And so it has so many features of the experiment that I think it's worth asking in that model what happens. And so I said it again, but the answer to your question, I believe, is in the GG part and not in the interaction. Yeah. I think, again, the way I see it failing is actually not so much in the interaction, but it fails with the G. And so somehow or another, I'm not being explicit enough, I think, but if I could see better, what I'm looking for, sorry, maybe I will find, I don't know. No, one more up. Oh, yeah, here you can see it. It's all right. This will do if I can just hit play. So what I'm saying is, everything we've seen as we go to, say, 0.9, and Neshat and I actually ran at 1, you know, where we know it's antiferromagnetic. This guy's doing really well, okay? But these guys, which have to do, you can't see it maybe, the BCS, those things are being killed by the Mott-ness opening up. And so, again, I'm not so sure it answers your question, but I would be happy myself to play RPA games. Unfortunately, I have to get this, but not this, because you don't get pseudo-gap out of RPA. At least I don't.